This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, director James Mangold's new movie is Walk the Line, but with movies like Heavy, Copland, Kate and Leopold, and I think really everything he's done, including Walk the Line, his movies work as ensemble pieces. There are a bunch of great performances in Walk the Line. Besides those, Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash and Reese Witherspoon as June Carter. First of all, Jim, thanks for being here.
Oh, no problem.
But I do think these movies really are ensemble pieces, and I think about how great the Sam Phillips is and how great the Jerry Lee Lewis is in this movie. And there are a bunch of really good performances, and I think you tend to work as a director, as somebody who wants to create a world of characters.
That's true. I mean, to me, it's funny. It's one of the – I always ask myself these kind of genre-specific questions and genre-challenging questions, if you will, which is that – in a funny way, when anyone describes a science fiction world or science fiction film, they talk about how you create a world. But it's always seemed to me since I started making movies that essentially that's our responsibility with whatever you're making. If you're making a movie about Memphis in the 50s, if you're making – you have to create a world and explain it, its mechanisms, its ways of gears interlocking, how it works, because it's a different world than the world we're living in. And anytime you're making – to me, the only movies I tend to be interested in are places where I can explain to you how this mental institution works, how this time in the past worked, how the world of Memphis in 1954 is different than now. And in that sense, I always think as if I were making Blade Runner. I'm going, how do I bring you into this world and explain how things are different, how it works, who's got the power, where do you go to get food, what's different about just the simple functions of life? But it also leads you into this sense when you think about world a lot, of a kind of canvas of characters. And the only other thing I think about with that is the word ensemble, because I'm never quite sure what – because I guess I've only made, quote, ensemble-y movies. I don't know what a non-ensemble – it's almost like you don't understand what the opposite would
be. When people talk about Walk the Line, and this one thing in just reading to prepare for this that sort of struck me, it doesn't get mentioned very often. It's an ensemble piece, that there are lots of people in it, because what happens in the way your movies get reviews, the actors who are the best known – are the ones who get the most attention.
That's true.
And even though these movies are very specifically not only ensemble pieces but pieces about displaced people who have a lot of anger and they're kind of attracted to each other by the way that they sort of help each other through the anger or not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, Reese doesn't appear till 35 minutes into the film. And I think it's some of the power of her performance is – I mean, it was a great lesson to me how – it isn't necessary – you know, you can go a long ways into the movie and still have someone enter the film. In fact, even more so if the film's been running on, you know, 5 out of 6 pistons and then you bring this last piece of the puzzle in and it knocks things and changes everything. And it's a kind of great – I mean, it was – for me in this film, it was a great piece of experimentation, was to see how far I could go. And when you bring this character in who really changes the world of the film instantly – to me structurally that was really interesting in this film.
Just The Treatment. We're talking to Jim Mangold, the director of Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash, June Carter Cash film. But for me too, you talking about that, we see Johnny Cash and then he disappears for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, so even he is – we see
well,
him.
Well, you see Boyhood Johnny Cash.
I'm sorry. We see Joaquin Phoenix. Forgive my imprecision. And then he goes away.
Yeah.
So even that is sort of a way of sort of toying with expectations somewhat.
Well, the opening of the movie was a very thought out thing for me where I was very conscious of several things. I mean, first of all, I'd wanted to make a film about John Cash for since 95. It was the first moment when
– Why since 95? What happened then?
Well, it was the first time anyone – in this case, Kathy Conrad, now my wife and partner but at that time producer of Copland, turned to me on the Jersey Shore and said, you know, you're in a moment where people want to know what you want to do next because they'll help you make it. And so what do you want to do next? And it was up to that point, I don't know quite how to explain it, but as a struggling filmmaker in New York, you don't feel able to say I want to make movies about people who have estates and rights and bajillions of dollars in music clearances. It doesn't really enter your mind as a possibility until, in a way, you have people helping you pull something like this off, or it somehow becomes made imaginable for you. And in this case, at that moment, when Kathy said that to me. I said, I want to make a movie about Johnny Cash. And I even had this thing in my head because I'm a huge East of Eden fan. And I always have these template films in my head when I make a movie. And in this case, I had this. I had been doing a lot of reading about John. I had been a fan since childhood of his music. And I had this idea about Sun Studios in the 50s, about seeing the birth of rock and roll, about John as this kind of ambassador through that world. But it's also the idea of him as a kind of, as Dean was in that Elia Kazan film, a kind of young man with a ton of shame on his back, looking for approval from a father who was withholding it, feeling tremendous attraction toward, in this case, in that film's case, his brother's girlfriend, his brother who was everything perfect, he who was everything shadowed, dark, and wrong. And Julie Harris plays Abra in the film, who is kind of the June of that movie. And it gave me a kind of North Star to look at while I was working on the script and writing the script with Gil Dennis, was this idea of how to shape it so that the script and the story were in a way concentrated. In the way, in my mind, a fiction film is concentrated and real life movies tend to fall down, is that they lose the focus, the kind of thematic focus that fictional films have, and become kind of these sprawling collection of tableaus of historical moments without something holding them together.
Well, that's fascinating to me because you're talking about a period where these performers were influenced by these movies they were seeing anyway. So there, it really is that kind of connection, that cultural and social connection between Johnny Cash and James Dean anyway.
Yeah, no, one of the really thrilling kind of moments where I felt I was onto something creatively as a writer and a director was I engage this process with this idea about East of Eden and James Dean in my head. And it means several things. One of which is when I'm looking for a Johnny Cash, an actor to play Johnny Cash, I'm thinking of I want James Dean, meaning but in my conversations with Johnny Cash as we were working on the script, one of the funny things that came up was I asked him, we were talking about his first wife, Vivian Liberto, and I said, you know, he married her literally weeks after returning from the service. And I said, what was it about her that that made you so sure, made you so crazy for her at the start? And he said two words, Pier Angeli. And Pier Angeli, for those who don't know in your audience, is an Italian actress who was brought to America in the 50s and ended up being James Dean's girlfriend in a period in the 50s as James
Dean. And there's this incredible triangle between James Dean and Salminio and Pier Angeli.
Right. And anyway, it knocked me backwards because, first of all, Johnny Cash with references like that, he always surprises you and always did surprise. I mean, he could talk about Elvis Costello albums or a Nirvana album or Jimmy Rogers with equal levels of knowledge. But that knocked me back. And then I was like, well, were you a James Dean fan? And he was like, oh, yeah. And he had seen all the movies. So now I'm busy structuring his early years based upon a film that he had clearly seen in that period. But what it told me was I was, in a sense, on the right track because the energies of Dean were clearly energies that appealed to him.
It's funny because you think about this. These are both guys, as actors and as performers, who broke away from what was presentational to being representational.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many facets of this story that fascinate me, and one of them, as a director of actors, was this kind of correlation between the Actors Studio in New York and Sam Phillips' studio in Memphis at Sun. And that essentially, because I found myself as I was, you know, this is a movie, despite its current success, which every single studio passed on out here financing, and every independent and dependent and all the forms they take passed on it. I mean, our literal last chance was 20th Century Fox. And one of the things as I was in all these studio presidents' offices pitching this movie, I would always realize is that when I talk about the birth of rock and roll, they really had no idea what I was talking about. In a sense, it meant something kind of nostalgic and kind of Sha-na-na-esque, something soft and dull and kind of like Happy Daisy and kind of
because they can only deal with it as an institution and not as an actual
yes,
social movement.
And as a kind of – and so the sensuality and the edge of this music, the idea of that was lost on them. And it didn't help that everyone's collective memory of Elvis is more a 40-year-old man stuffed into a white leather jumpsuit than it is a 19-year-old man wailing his head off in a studio in Memphis. And it doesn't help in that sense that John, everyone's collective memory of John at that moment is the Hurt video making the rounds, and that in a sense everyone's having a very hard time attaching a kind of understanding of what is the birth of rock and roll? What other than a phrase used to market a moment in albums, what is that? What happened at that moment? And I found myself going, what's the difference between Errol Flynn and Marlon Brando? What's the difference between James Dean and Cary Grant? I go, in a sense, that's what happened in Memphis. That's the birth of rock and roll. That is what happened musically. The hit of the moment in, you know, how much is that doggy in the window was the hit of America in 1954. Doris Day was one of our biggest pop stars. There was, even in country music, this Owen Bradley sound, the kind of Patsy Cline, almost cosmopolitan, I go walking after midnight, very rounded, very soft, almost not country. I have nothing against that music. It's beautiful. But it's not the edge that was Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams. It was...
No, it's orchestrated.
I yes. mean. And it was... Everything happening, even in country music at that moment, was moving away from this kind of raw, primitive, real, edgy, sensual, scary, violent sound. And that's what these young men brought back in this room to popular music.
Let me take a minute and say it's a treatment. My guest is the writer-director Jim Mangold. His new film is Walk the Line. We're talking about the social movements that led to this film and basically were the building blocks of what you want to do with the film. It's fascinating, too, because you think about these guys. Elvis Presley was doing Dean Martin, right down to dyeing his hair black and starting to mumble so he could do that. And to have Cash, who really was – and all the things – and I had a chance to meet him once. You just were talking, but you realized what he was attracted to, even in the poetry he liked, were people who were comfortable revealing their pain. And that's that sort of vulnerability is what he was obviously seeing in both – clearly Pierre Angelé and also James Dean too, wouldn't you say?
I'd say that John was always someone fascinated by honesty. And I think so often honesty in – I think this is true for many of the actors I get a chance to work with, is that we almost get dulled in our work in a haze of bullshit, especially in show business. We're just kind of – where so many of us are encased and surrounded with praise and nurturing remarks. Even when the news is bad, people find a way of telling you good. And that I think that people – someone like John was always attracted not to the bad news but to the real word, and that whatever that was – if he felt pain, if he felt sincerity. I think that's how, in a sense, I got the chance to make this film was I think it wasn't really when people ask me, what did you say to John? The first thing I said is I wanted to make a movie about this period, and I talked about East of Eden and all that. But I have a feeling in my gut, I think he just looked in my eyes and thought, he's a decent human being and he wants this really bad. And
he saw that vulnerability. He saw you exposing yourself. Because you think about this.
That's what John was. And that's what John – I mean, and that's what that moment at Sun was. That's what's so exciting to me about that, and what I hoped indirectly – not like a Discovery Channel documentary, but like indirectly on this journey of love and this quest in the film, you feel this thing happening that doesn't feel like, quote, oldies or some kind of, you know, rocking with the hits 95 kind of cheese ass thing, but feels as vital and sexual as I think that moment felt in music when they first started making it. And you feel why this stuff became red hot with a bullet immediately, both commercially and just spiritually.
We'll take a break. My guest is director James Mangold. His new film is Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash biography with Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is writer-director James Mangold. His new film is Walk the Line. I keep thinking, too, about these movies. All these movies of yours are this thing that you talked about with Cash, about people who are vulnerable, being around other people who are vulnerable, and the conflicts that arise out of that, you know? I mean, there's one person who's almost a little more vulnerable, a little more of an – has less of a skin, an outer layer to protect himself, be it Angelina Jolie or certainly Joaquin in this movie or Stallone in Copland. There's one person who's exposed.
I'd even take that a step further. I think I've been really fascinated with the frozen male, with I think it's also something that started to get explored at that moment with the arrival of the great male actors of New York of that period in the 50s, which is just this, the idea of the anti-hero or the stuck man, stuck between his sensitivity and his kindness or his tenderness and artisticness and the kind of primeval Clint Eastwoodness of himself, and how males navigate that, from Freddie Heflin in Copland to Pruitt Taylor Vince in Heavy to Johnny Cash in Walk the Line, is something I've been really fascinated with. And to get back to something we started with, where you're talking about ensembles, when you make movies, which I tend to, and actually I think Winona's character in Girl Interrupted falls here easily, is that when you make films about passive characters, characters who are kind of on a ride but are not quite sure how to control the train that they're on, you need a strong ensemble in order to make the engine of the film work, because in a sense, because they're not active in the kind of John Wayne leading the men across the range in search of the men who killed his brother, because they're in a way on a ride, like so many of us are in the late 20th and early 21st century, on a kind of ride in our lives, not sure how much we can control our destiny, in order to make the engine of drama work, you need characters pushing and pulling on them. Strong characters with dynamic agendas to somehow make the film function and not actually become a vision of staticness.
Well, I would ask you, because it feels to me this way, there's a tribal aspect to these movies about these guys being one way on their own and being pulled in something else around other guys, you know, or around other people. I mean
Well, that's an element of the world. I mean, that thing we're talking about where you want
– That's not often an element
I want to
of
feel
movies,
that,
though.
I mean, when I made Girl Interrupted, all I thought about was The Wizard of Oz, and I think that's one of the most geniusly structured movies of all time for me, a huge touchstone. But what a world. I mean, and what a film about depression if you really think about it.
But really, it's a film about psychosis.
It is. And to me, it was the perfect – you know, people – because he was a teacher of mine, Milos Forman, people always thought when I've made that movie, I must be watching Cuckoo's Nest every other day. And the truth was that nothing was more frighteningly present over my head than Cuckoo's Nest. What I was watching every day was The Wizard of Oz, and thinking about every day was that. But for me, there's always that film, that template film, but there's also that feeling of trying to get somehow deeper into what you're exploring through the world, not just the character.
I want to talk to you about that too, because I know that you study film, and one of your – somebody who meant a lot to you was the director Alexander McKendrick, who also made these films too that were incredibly tribal in that way about these people, and also sort of about how guys were off on their own and then coming to these worlds. They felt they had to sort of make a kind of impression and be a different kind of person, and that sort of transitional thing, which is – in those movies he made in the 50s is very much like the beginnings of – that acting style of being presentational and playing everything from the outside disappearing too.
Yeah, no, I mean Sandy's career literally kind of tracks between the more presentational pictures like The Lady Killers and Man in the White Suit and Whiskey Galore, all the way to Sandy making the film many probably know of his that would they'd have a hard time connecting with The Ealing Years, which would be Sweet Smell of Success. I think one of the great, great films, period.
But also plays like comedy.
Absolutely.
Almost.
And like a kind of – and with a density – of script and character relationships that's, to me, a kind of tabula rasa of just it's always a lesson. It's always something to look at. There's always something for me to learn from that film.
What did you get from him as a teacher? What did you get from him as
– The first thing I got from Sandy was – I mean when I came to CalArts, I was 17 years old. I'd grown up in upstate New York. I'd been making movies with my dad's Super 8 camera since I was 11. And I had achieved a kind of – technical proficiency, probably beyond most kids' years at that point. I was a total geek, editing double system in my attic and lighting myself, animating double system sound, doing wild mixes. But I hadn't been happy in the sense that while my films impressed people and they were technically proficient, they were dead to me. They didn't make you cry or laugh. I wanted to be moved. I wanted to be as moved as I was when I watched movies that did that to me. And what... what Sandy eventually brought me to, besides kind of teaching me, I mean, when you ask, what did Sandy teach me? The first thing, the greatest gift would be just how hard I would have to work. He was incredibly demanding. I would write a really three-page short script idea, and he'd write seven pages in longhand about what he thought about it. And I still look back on my notes and that stuff from those days, and I go, that kind of generosity is so moving to me. What I was handing him was a late-night cobbled-together crap of a young, distracted man away at art school for his first year, and what I was getting back was the intelligent, thoughtful, thorough response of one of our greatest filmmakers, handwritten on seven pages. And the truth is that what he did and that kind of generosity did get through to me. I suddenly realized that his greatest lesson to us there was how hard you were going to have to work to make a decent film. His second great thing was he told me after 2 years, and I had been his teaching assistant at that point, he told me I'd have to go in the acting school, and he wasn't going to speak to me for my third year and unless I did. But it was the greatest year of my life. I actually applied, auditioned for the CalArts Theater School, and became a member of one of their acting studios, along with Don Cheadle, who was actually there for his first year that year. I was in his acting – we were in several plays together. And that was actually, I mean, honestly, the best year of my life. I had more fun that year, and I completely dropped thinking for a moment about lenses and focal lengths and f-stops and multiple exposures and green screens and all the other geeky American cinematographer stuff that young filmmakers tend to only be thinking about. And suddenly I was knee-deep in just story and character and having to be. And I loved it, first of all. I mean, it was – I loved performing myself, but it was something I had let go exploring film. And it was a huge revelation to me because it allowed me to begin to fold, I hope, greater skills with actors back into the work, the technically proficient but dead work I had been making.
It's The Treatment. My guest is writer, director James Mangold, whose new film is Walk the Line. But as you talk about this and watching your films, the thing I saw that seems most evident to me from McKendrick's work is that thing of him having people in a room and that tension of just being trapped in a room with these people who are assigning themselves these roles and sort of fighting for primacy in that room.
Well, you know, there's a thing Sandy would do to analyze the script, and I have done this on every movie of mine, in which he draws circles for each character in the fabric, in the world, if you will, as we're talking about this, of the movie. And then he draws lines between every one of these circles. Like if you had a character like John Cash, right, and then you have his first wife, Vivian, and you have June, and you have his band, and you have all these other circles, he'd want you to be able to talk about every one of these lines discreetly. You'd understand each relationship in its own special way, even if these it's an indirect relationship, his relationship with the record company, his relationship with – that by the end you'd have this tangle, this kind of incredible web of connections on a piece of paper, and he'd number each one of these lines, and we'd have to talk about every one of these relationships. And I don't think there's anything better for a screenwriter, actually, because I think most dead screenplays tend to have, in a sense, characters walk into a room in a dead screenplay, and they haven't thought about what comes next, and they haven't thought about – in the way we all do. I come here to the studio. I'm wondering, what is this going to be like? Who am I going to meet? How do I feel about this? Oh, I've heard his show. I'm meeting him in the hallway. There's all sorts of connections that affect my behavior and the way I speak in this situation. And when we don't think out all those strands of connection that a person can have to each new place and world they walk into, we in effect deaden them.
But that's in effect what actors do. I mean, if an actor only has two lines, really, and he's diligent about the work and about the craft, he's thought about what this character has done before he walks into this room, has his two lines, what he's going to do after that.
But great acting comes from great writing. I mean, if that were true, then the reason, you know, every episode of Different Strokes or it isn't Oscar caliber is just simply because the actors weren't good enough. It's not true. It's that sometimes the writing is without greater reach intentionally. And sometimes the writing is that embedded in the writing are in the word choices, in the ways people enter and exit, who's there, who's not. There is something latently in the text.
So I've got to ask you this.
Yeah.
If you're doing this work, how much effort you have to put it in so it doesn't seem schematic, so it doesn't seem like you've worked out this scheme where
you throw it all away.
You do.
What Sandy would say is you know it all, just like the actor. In a sense, your responsibility as a writer and director is exactly like the actor. You do all this work and then it goes away. And then you write the scene. And what's there is there.
You've actually been working pretty steadily for the past 10 years, and you write and you go make a movie, then you – so you're constantly doing this. How does that change for you? Because these movies have been in such different arenas and such different types, you know, a fairly intimate, small-scale melodrama like Heavy to Girl Interrupted, to Copland, to this movie. They're very different kinds of movies.
There's a weird rebellious nature in me where I feel like as long as people are giving me a chance to keep exploring genre, why not? I mean, that it's almost – I mean, I think in almost every art form we've gotten to this point where – and I know young directors are aware of this. It's almost better to brand yourself as the master of horror or the master of comedies or than not to. But so often that comes from the fact that what people are allowing you to do is what you've done before. In my case, because I started with a film as kind of small, as you say, and melodramatic as Heavy, and then made immediately afterward a kind of much larger scale cop film – people never could figure out what the hell I was. So in that, it became my advantage. Like, is he Hollywood or is he indie? Is he dramatic or is he cop movie guy? Or is he – and then suddenly I'm making an all-female film in Girl Interrupted. And then Kate and Leopold, which completely reverses the previous three. And that for me, I was trying to have an experience that I would think most filmmakers would want to have, which is just I'm following my gut and my interest. And I'm kind of – at the same time learning tons. I mean, the two films I made before Walk the Line, Kate and Leopold and Identity, this thriller with John Cusack and the rain in a
– Yeah, and really an ensemble piece.
Truly an ensemble piece.
in which nothing –
Many is one.
and which in the way nothing is what it seems.
Absolutely. I mean,
which is something also that –
For a studio picture also I thought wildly crazy picture. For me – though those two movies, Identity and Kate and Leopold, because I knew, frankly, as I walked to the set every day and was working on the script, I knew I wasn't making a, quote, Oscar picture. I knew I was making a kind of genre movie. In both cases, there was a kind of pressure that didn't exist to be great in a kind of terrible way, a kind of pressure like as a young filmmaker, you're like where you – are pounding your head so hard and preparing and thinking all night before you shoot that actually sometimes you're doing your work a disservice, and that there was something about the relaxation with which I approached those two movies and the fun I had making them that when it came time to make a film where I was deeply aware of the judgment of that there'd be huge amounts of judgment and concern and thought about the film and talk about the film – I managed to hold on to that life preserver of kind of levity and relaxation I had making the previous, and I think it really helped this film and helped the performances in that sense that I didn't always arrive with, you know, like the thinker with my knuckles to my forehead going, you know, like some kind of mad, horrible, I don't know. There's something in that. There's something in breathing and enjoying the process as opposed to kind of being gritting your teeth and trying so hard.
Well, out of time, Jim. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, man.
My guest is director James Mangold. His new film is Walk the Line. Our technical director at KCRW is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Treatment. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Business, a look deep inside the business of entertainment with Hollywood's top dealmakers, filmmakers, moguls, artists, and agents. Hosted by Claude Brodesser. Check out the podcast of The Business at kcrw.com.